The commission is hereby convened in open session December 20th, 2012 to consider the matter entitled Mark Gray versus North Fork Coal Corporation, docket number Kent 2010-430-D. Present are myself, Chairman Jordan, Commissioner Young, and Commissioner Nakamura. We will start with an overview of the case presented by John Sullivan. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Chairman and Commissioners. This case involves a discrimination complaint filed by miner Mark Gray pursuant to Section 105(c)(3) of the Federal Mine Safety and Health Act of 1977 against North Fork Coal Corporation. The Commission Administrative Law Judge ultimately found against Mr. Gray and dismissed his complaint. The Commission then granted Mr. Gray's petition for discretionary review. The background of the case is as follows. For roughly three decades, Mr. Gray has worked in a number of mines, much of that time as a roof bolter. He took just such a position with the North Fork Mine in Lector County, Kentucky, in the winter of 2007, starting on a night maintenance shift before eventually moving to a day production shift. At the mine, after a continuous miner operator would make a cut into coal, a two-man team operating a roof bolter would install bolts in the newly cut area to support the roof, protecting it from collapsing. It was also the job of that team to hang curtains behind the bolting machine to ensure proper airflow and ventilation to the face. On May 15, 2009, North Fork terminated Gray's employment on the grounds of poor performance. A month later, Gray filed a complaint with the Department of Labor's Mine Safety and Health Administration, alleging that its dismissal was actually due to his making safety complaints to his immediate supervisor, day shift foreman Thomas Cornett. Specifically, Gray contends that on May 5, 2009, a 50 to 60 foot cut of coal was made, which he and his partner had then had to bolt. This was not only in violation of the mine's roof control plan in effect at the time, but was well beyond the length of cut normally taken at the mine, which is known to have an unstable roof. Gray alleges that 3 days later, a second cut of 50 or more feet was made, which he refused to bolt. Gray also testified later at hearing that shortly thereafter, during an instance in which he stopped the roof bolting to hang curtains, Cornett acted angry and mumbled something under his breath, and thereafter was not friendly towards him and acted differently. During the MSHA investigation into Gray's complaint, the agency obtained from North Fork copies of two written warnings purportedly signed by Gray that the operator contended had put Gray on notice regarding his poor performance. Gray denied that he signed such notices. The Secretary of Labor was successful in obtaining a temporary reinstatement for Gray while MSHA investigated his claims further. The parties then agreed to economic reinstatement in lieu of Mr. Gray returning to work at the mine. The Secretary thereafter decided not to pursue a discrimination complaint. Consequently, Gray initiated his own action under Section 105(c)(3). The possibility that Gray's signatures were forged by North Fork officials remained the subject of an investigation by MSHA and the local United States Attorney during much of 2010, while this case was in discovery. During that time, the originals of the warnings remained under the control of investigators, which prevented the documents from being examined as part of Gray's discrimination case. After consultation with the parties, including regarding this issue, on September 8th, the judge set the case for trial on December 15th, with a discovery cutoff of December 3rd. On November 2nd, North Fork served discovery on Gray, requesting him to name the witnesses he expected to call at trial. On November 24th, Gray responded with his list of witnesses and explained that while he expected to call a handwriting expert, he could not as yet provide the identity of the expert due to his just having secured permission from the government to have an expert examine the original documents. On December 2nd, Gray retained an expert, and on December 3rd, supplemented his interrogatory answers to identify that expert. Gray did likewise on December 6th when he retained a second such expert. In the meantime, North Fork had filed a motion in limine, arguing to the judge that Gray had failed to timely provide the identity of any expert, and thus should not be permitted to call a handwriting expert at trial. On December 6th, having learned the identities of both proposed expert witnesses, North Fork filed another such motion, arguing for identical relief on the ground that the second expert witness had been disclosed beyond the previously established discovery cutoff date. After a conference call hearing with the parties the next day on the pending motions, the judge excluded the expert witness testimony and issued an order to that effect, and denied Gray's request that the hearing date be postponed while discovery with respect to the expert's reports was conducted. The judge shortly thereafter also denied Gray's request that she would consider her order or certify the issue for commission interlocutory review. The commission subsequently denied Gray's petition for an interlocutory review, and the judge held the hearing as scheduled. In her subsequent decision on the merits of Gray's discrimination complaint, the judge ruled that Gray had failed to establish that he had engaged in protected activity and thus had failed to carry his burden of showing a prima facie case of discrimination under the Mine Act. In doing so, the judge refused to credit Gray's account of the deep cuts he alleged occurred and Cornett's treatment of him with respect to the hanging of the curtain. The judge did credit the company's witnesses that contradicted Gray's testimony, and both their testimony and documentary evidence in the form of Cornett's daily log with regard to Gray's poor work and unsafe work performance as a roof bolter, which the judge concluded established that, even if Gray had engaged in protected activity, the company had an affirmative defense to the charge of discrimination. Relying on the testimony of Gray's roof bolting partner, the judge concluded that Gray's discrimination complaint was nothing more than a pretext designed to counter the operator's decision to let him go. On review, Gray contends that the judge abused her discretion in her pretrial rulings with respect to the expert evidence. Gray argues that there was no basis for the judge to invoke the ultimate sanction of exclusion of evidence in this instance, where the judge had not established a deadline for parties to identify expert witnesses. Gray contends that evidence of the forgery of his signature on the supposedly prior warnings undermines the credibility of North Fork's witnesses, and thus he should have been permitted by the judge to pursue the issue through the expert testimony at the hearing. North Fork responds that the judge did not abuse her discretion in excluding the proffered expert reports and testimony. The operator contends that the proffered expert evidence would not have established forgery in any event, and there is insufficient evidence that the experts were prepared to testify at trial regarding their reports. North Fork also argues that the prior warnings are only relevant as to whether North Fork established the affirmative defense of Gray's poor work performance and would not affect the primary issue the judge decided, which was that Gray had failed to establish that he had engaged in protected activity. I'll be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, John. Are there any questions at this time, Mr. John? Okay, Commissioner
McNamara
will lead off our discussion today.
Thank you, John, for your help in this case, the description of the summary that you gave. I think it's very complete. This is certainly a case that's not an ordinary one for this commission. 105C discrimination case involving an alleged forged document and the miner's asserted need for testimony of a handwriting expert. I don't know if we've had a case like this before. I've only been here a couple of years, but we haven't had one in that time. I would find that the judge erred when she precluded the miner from presenting the expert testimony of Mr. Miller and Mr. Valcastro. Actually, I hate to use the term abuse of discretion, but I guess that's the legal standard. It sounds kind of personal, but in any event, if we need to use it, then I find that she abused her discretion in precluding the expert testimony. First off, I don't think the miner violated any discovery rules or orders in prohibiting in providing the names of the experts and producing their reports beyond the discovery dates, the deadline dates. And I would say that there's some discrepancy in when the answers were due because of the issue of whether or not they were emailed to counsel for the miner. And we know from the commission rules, if it's sent by first class mail, then under our rules, the recipient gets an additional 5 days to answer. So, but I don't think that's critical here. The minor counsel did send a response on November 24th, which would have been within 25 days, indicating, setting forth the witnesses that he was expecting to call, and indicating at that time that he was expecting to call an expert who had not yet been determined. There's no indication in the record that the answers to these interrogatories were not true at the time he sent them. And in fact, I think in the first motion in limine filed by the operator was asserting that he didn't think that the counsel for the minor had been able to obtain the original documents from the government at that time. So that certainly implies that he didn't think that he had the documents and had the expert at that time. So I don't think the answers were, is there any indication that the answers that were provided on that were not true? He then got an expert later and supplemented his answers as he's required to do twice. So I think based on this, I think the minor complied with the discovery rules and a sanction was not warranted under Section 59. Of course, that doesn't end the inquiry. It seems to me that the operator's and the judge's real beef with the minor's counsel was that having filed the case a year before, he only obtained the experts shortly before trial. So, and there's no doubt that the designation of the experts and the production of the reports came late in the game. But there are facts in the record that lead me to conclude that under the circumstances, the judge nonetheless erred in imposing an extreme sanction of precluding the testimony of these witnesses. And I base that on several reasons. First, there are facts in the record that support the minor's assertion that he was having unusual difficulty in securing the original warning letters. And a handwriting expert needs the originals. He can't do an analysis of copies, no matter how good those copies are. Especially that in this case, there were some indications of, I think, proffered proffer at the trial that the handwriting expert was going to show that these were not authentic signatures by Mark Gray. And I think you can only do that, at least in my experience, with original copies. In the record, there's a letter that was sent to the judge on September 7th, a copy of a letter sent to the judge on September 7th from a Carolyn James of MSHA. And what the record shows is that Mr. Uppegard, for the minor's counsel on July 1st, as early as July 1st, 2010, wrote to MSHA Special Investigator Gary Harris, just down the road in Barbieville, Kentucky, to inquire about obtaining the original letters. Over 2 months later, on September 7th, Mr. Oppegard gets a response, not from Mr. Harris, but from Carolyn James, the Assistant Director of Technical Compliance and Investigation in Arlington, not indicating that she had the letters or she was going to give them over, but that there was a matter concerning the forgery of the documents that had been referred to the Justice Department as part of an ongoing law enforcement action. So, again, it's an unusual case. And Although the record's not entirely clear, it suggests to me that the ongoing criminal matter caused the delay in the minor's ability to get the original letters. And, you know, the specter of this criminal matter continued on, even through the hearing, because one of the witnesses, transcript shows that one of the witnesses, Russell Ison, I-S-O-N, who was mine superintendent in the first warning notice, which was allegedly issued, when he was asked about the notice, he invoked his Fifth Amendment right not to incriminate himself. So that was all going on. And an unusual circumstance, and I find a factor in assessing this case. A second factor is the counsel for the minor pointed out, in this particular case, there was no deadline for the designation of expert witnesses or report. There's no deadline in the commission rules, and there was no deadline in any of the pre-hearing orders. And, you know, I would point out that, at least in federal court, generally there's a scheduling order that provides for specific deadlines for experts. In fact, if you go to Form 52 of the federal rules, you'll see that the sample report of the party's planning meeting, paragraph 3I, indicates that there should be specific dates for exchanging reports of expert witnesses. And there wasn't one in this case. And it makes sense because experts come to the case late. They're not fact witnesses. They come in after the case has been filed. They generally have to do something to either investigate a crime scene or look at specific evidence, or in this case, look at the warning letters and then come up with a report. That's usually the plaintiff or the minor in this case, and that's provided to the other side, and they can decide whether they want to get an expert and have a report prepared. And then there's deposition taken. So there's a reason why experts are treated differently. And in this particular, and like I said, this is an unusual case before the commission, parties use experts, usually they're ventilation experts. But in this particular case, this one was different. So it may just be that our particular form orders were not set up for this. But in any case, there was no deadline. And I don't think a discovery deadline or a promulgation of discovery necessarily implies or creates such a deadline in an order. I guess if discovery had never been promulgated, then clearly the minor's attorney could have just shown up at trial and said, here's my expert. There was no deadline for exchange. I don't think that the fact that the operator promulgated discovery to identify witnesses necessarily imposed that the party had to get the expert by the discovery. And as I said, in this case, the circumstances excuses this particular in this particular case, the minor from being able to do that. So I think the bottom line here is that for me, all of this indicates that the minor's attorney was not engaging in any kind of bad faith or willfulness in failing to designate an expert earlier than he did. Under these circumstances, I do not think it was appropriate for the judge to conclude testimony of the two experts, which is a very extreme sanction, sort of a spectrum of sanctions. I think there were alternatives, including continuing the trial or legally leaving the record open for the purposes of maybe trial depositions and then allowing the certainly the company, the operators, side to obtain their own expert if necessary. Finally, I would say that I don't think this error was harmless. I understand what the judge found in this case, but to me, the judge's findings were based in significant part on testimony of several management employees, including Mr. Estevez and Count Mr. Estevez and the superintendent and Countess, the day shift monitor, and others. And she credited their testimony, actually discussed the credibility of this witness. And, you know, if the minor can prove that documents were forged, I think that's significant. And to me, it would allow the trier of fact to question the validity of the operator's whole case. I think it could put it in doubt. That's up to the trier of fact, whether it be jury or, in this case, a judge. And those warning notices, you know, could be important. There was another, you know, two roof bolters operated in tandem, and I think they were talking about slowness of their work. But Mr. Sheeks, yeah, I don't know whether he was written up, and certainly he wasn't discharged for working slowly. So based on all of the above, I would remand the case back to the judge with instructions to allow the testimony of Miller and Belcastro. With respect to Belcastro, I didn't mention that, but because he was worked for the FBI, there's a question of whether the government would allow him to testify in the case. I don't think permission had actually been given at the time the trial started. The judge would, I think, need to give the minor a deadline to secure permission, and the minor would have to try to secure that permission as soon as possible. The operator would have the opportunity to get its own expert if it wishes, and then the deposition of the of the experts could be taken by both sides. Perhaps the depositions of the experts could be by videotape, the trial depositions. But it does also seem to me that the parties may still need to call for their witnesses. Or for the testimony in light of the testimony of the experts. So there might have to be a hearing convened. Mr. Estevez, Mr. Cowdis, and Mr. Eisen, they want to reply to the experts' report. So. But that's for the judge and the parties to sort out. Finally, I want to say, even though I'm ruling the way I am in this case, that I am, in the back of my mind the whole time was the fact that the judges have a very large backlog of cases. And case management is very important. And I certainly don't want my decision in this case to encourage any slackers out there who don't abide by the judge's scheduling orders. I just find, for the reasons I've already given, that in this particular case, there were grounds for why I feel that the expert's testimony, though late in the game, designated late in the game, should be allowed.
Thank you very much, Commissioner Nakamura. We'll now hear from Commissioner Young.
Thank you, Madam Chair. thank John Sullivan very much, not only for his maintaining the record, keeping us on track of this issue, of this particular review. This is a case that reflects, has appeared to us in many guises and before several other fora. John's been on top of it and has kept us apprised of the developments of the case and made sure that so we were aware of everything that's going on. I very much appreciate his efforts in that regard. I am generally in agreement with Commissioner Nakamura, including verbatim, that I do also hate to call this an abuse of discretion on the part of the judge. I'm very hesitant to get involved in second guessing what they do, telling them how to manage pretrial matters and hearings. Their expertise, their awareness of all of the circumstances before them, the parties, and their situation, the evidentiary needs, and their own schedules are deserving of our respect and deference. I would also look at this matter and have to agree that the judge said, but for Mr. Gray's testimony in the matter, which she did not find credible, there isn't any evidence whatsoever of any deep cuts being taken in the mine. And without the deep cuts, there's no protected activity. And without protected activity, there's no discrimination claim. I would suggest also that the secretary had a chance to look at this and find Mr. Gray's complaint, his presentation of it, to be sufficiently compelling to support a continued involvement in the case. But I'm nonetheless troubled by the exclusion of this expert testimony, generally for the same reasons that Commissioner Hackburn is troubled. The harshness of the remedy, one disfavored by the courts of law. Like most other tribunals, have a strong preference that cases be decided on their merits with all available competent and relevant evidence. I want to stress, I don't have an opinion, and I'm not offering an opinion on the quality of this evidence. It just seems to be the type of evidence that would typically be used to support a claim of forgery. And it should be evaluated as such by the finder of fact if the claim is relevant to the case. And I do think it's relevant. Secondly, in looking at this, while I might not completely agree with Commissioner Nakamura, although I generally do, about whether or not Mr. Gray's counsel was fully in compliance with the rules of the discovery framework that was established by the judge, any breach of those rules seems to be de minimis in comparison with the sanction imposed. So I think that even if I were to believe personally that you don't have an expert and truthfully state that before the deadline and then have an expert after the deadline, if there's a deadline, you might be playing fast and loose with the rules. I'm not even sure that that's the situation here, but even if it was, it was not very far beyond the deadline at all. That might be construed. Now, you don't view these things in isolation. When the judge had whatever experience she had in dealing with the parties, again, we ought to respect that, but you have to consider, speaking of not thinking of things in isolation, how important this evidence turned out to be in Mr. Gray's case. In fact, he had no case at all without this evidence, I don't believe. Or if the judge finds it unpersuasive, then there's no point. I'm not completely certain that the central importance of this evidence was made apparent to the judge the way that the issue was managed on Mr. Gray's behalf. But the central importance became evident at trial. In addition to the direct testimony of the management witness, the operator, which basically stated unequivocally that Mr. Gray had signed this document. He has two minor witnesses. By minors, I mean minors who were working as coal miners. Testify that Mr. Gray had said to them that he had been written up for performance. There's nothing else in his record. his personnel record to indicate that he had been disciplined in writing. So either these warnings occurred or they did not occur. And if they didn't occur, there's no reason Mr. Gray would have told these monitors that he'd been written up that I can see in the record. And so that calls into question the credibility of their testimony as well. In a case such as this one, it turns largely, although not exclusively, on credibility assigned to the testimony of witnesses. I really think that a full analysis of the credibility requires this evidence to be considered. And that really brings me to my final most critical reason for requiring reconsideration of this case, to include the excluded evidence and any further testimony that Mr. McMurdo listed that might be necessary to ensure that this issue is resolved. Some evidence is of such character that its exclusion would really cast some doubt on the integrity of our proceedings. I mean, here we've got an allegation of dishonesty that has to be brought into the light of critical evaluation. One way or the other, the judge needs to find it. Forgery is not a forgery. If it's a forgery, does it affect the credibility of the witnesses? Have. So I think it's important that everyone who appears before us know and understand that we're committed to whatever the burden is. And there's a real burden here of sending this thing back, and I get that. But we're willing to assume that burden to ensure our hearings are focused on just results distilled from evaluation of all of the relevant evidence. Again, I'm mindful of how difficult this is, and that it does put a hardship on the judge and on the parties, and I regret that. But I don't believe it serves the interest of justice to allow an unresolved allegation of false testimony and evidence to hang in the air. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Commissioner Young. I appreciate my colleague's comments and find them very thoughtful, but I am unable to join in their view. I struggled with the question of whether the judge abused her discretion for excluding the testimony, and I think it's very, very close. But as my colleagues point out, it is a deferential standard. The judge does have discretion to manage the case in the pre-hearing discovery decision. And she did set a hearing date. She had originally wanted to set a hearing date in July of 2010, but was asked by complainant to not schedule it then to allow them to have more time to obtain the expert witness. The operator did file a first set of interrogatories. They were not answered. They filed their interrogatories in January of 2010, and they had to file a motion to compel, ultimately, to get those answered. They served a second set of interrogatories, which also were answered after a motion to compel was filed. The expert witness was ultimately identified, but after a motion in limine was filed to exclude testimony. So there were, I think there's things, you know, factors that the judge can take into account, and although I do feel this is close, I mean, she set a hearing date. The hearing was set for December 15th, I believe. And, you know, usually even under our rules, the discovery should end a certain amount of days before the hearing. And I think that would be shorter here. You know, usually 10 or 20 days a year. It was really just going to be about 10 days that the discovery deadline was going to end before the hearing. So I think that, and we do have, you know, the statute does say that the discrimination case is going to be handled fairly expeditiously. So the judge needs to be weighing all these factors. But I appreciate my colleague's views, and I, you know, I did feel this was very close, and I went back and forth. But The other factor in my decision is I realize, in a sense, I almost would not even need to reach the question of whether the judge abused her discretion here, because in my view, I do find it persuasive, the argument that whether the excluded evidence would affect the complainant's substantial rights here. The complainant, in order to have a discrimination case, you first need to show that you engaged in protected activity. And the complainant said that his protected activity was that he refused to bolt an extended cut. There were no witnesses that supported that fact that there was ever an extended cut made in mine. The witnesses that did testify to that, and these were not just management level witnesses, they were the complainant's other roof vaulting partner, Shaq, I believe his name is, the other two roof vaulting team who would have, you know, been in the area, would have known if was there a, you know, extended cut made, the continuous miner operator and the immediate foreman all testified there were no extended cuts made at that mine, in that area, and that the roof conditions were such that in fact they were making cuts that were generally less than what the roof bolt plan allowed at that time. But so the judge evaluated the credibility of all these witnesses and his great contention that he in fact first was asked to bolt an extended cut and did bolt it, but that's the second time he was asked to refuse, and that led to his discharge. But she evaluated all that testimony and made her credibility determinations. And so I, even if, and then looking at the excluded testimony here, the proffer that counsel made was that there was one witness, Mr. Miller, that whose report would indicate there might be a high likelihood of discrepancy, that the signature of Mr. Gray was not genuine. The other excluded testimony, as my colleague pointed out, it was not clear there would be a witness available. It's just a report. And the report was more equivocal that there was perhaps some discrepancies in signatures. But in order to, I just, in considering requiring the excluded evidence to be allowed in, I just honestly found it extremely difficult to figure out how so many dots that would have to be connected would wind up being connected with this testimony, because the testimony went to the fact of whether there was a genuine signature on the document that was reportedly given to Mr. Gray or in his record warning him about his bad work history, his non-productive work history. That doesn't really directly go to the question, you know, the fact of that was asked of all these other witnesses, were there any extended cuts made at this mine? But even if the credibility determinations were so upended that, you know, that there was a determination made that Mr. Gray was credible and there was extended cuts made, that would allow him to make out his prima facie case, but the operator would still have the opportunity to prove that they would have fired him anyway. And there was, let me just go back and also refer to the fact there was other evidence the judge noted in determining the credibility determinations on the extended cuts, which was that Mr. Gray, there, on the day he was fired, there was an MSHA inspector at the mine. Houston area, he did not make any notification to that inspector about the issue of extended custody. And that was taken into account. But the operator would still be putting on evidence to show that they would have fired Mr. Gray nevertheless, regardless of the protected activity. There was significant evidence in the record, particularly there were logs by put into evidence, notations by his foreman of time that there were problems with the slowness production by Mr. Gray. So, in considering the issue here and the proffer made regarding the excluded evidence, I really found myself unable to conclude that even if it was error to exclude that it required us to vacate that decision, that I could come to the conclusion that there was such, that it would affect his substantial, that his substantive rights, given the ruling that the judge made regarding the other evidence and the record. So that's where I've come down.
Cornette, you mean?
Cornette.
No, I don't believe he produced the actual log. Not the original one.
Not the original.
It was notes that he said he had taken
right.
From the